everybody. I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and at a meeting and seeking recovery and seeking to continue to wake up with this power, this loving power that's kept me sober since he separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. I'd like to thank Walter and the group for this very kind invitation to me to be up here tonight to share with all of you. I'm very grateful to be most places today sober and awake compared to the days when I would maybe show up on time and get asked to leave very quickly and never invited back. And, you know, it's pretty neat to be invited places and they tell you come back and speak next year, come back in 6 months later and get invited to many, many places to carry this message. It's an opportunity that's been presented to me by loving God since I got sober. And he has guided me and moved me to many places, to many homes, have people come into my home to be on the firing line. What a good deal. It wasn't like that before I got here in 1988. It truly is a blessing for me to stand here tonight with dignity and share a message that has been freely given to me. God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. I'm here tonight as a recovered alcoholic, no longer suffering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I've been set free of alcoholism and many of the things that accompany alcoholism by having an awakened spirit. I was brought to this fellowship in 1988 at a place of begging for a drink by way of 7 rehabs, living in the street, being homeless and panhandling, doing a lot of ugly things for the price of a drink. And I come here in 1988, and something moved me, it was God, to seek the solution. And I found myself begging for a solution, contrary to begging for a drink. And there were some wonderful people that met me in Minnesota, My life was consisted of picking friends, and every time I picked friends, they were just as bad or worse than me. And since I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, God has put people in my path who have allowed me to wake up. And some of those people were giving me the message from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So upon entering this fellowship, this sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is sacred, and if you haven't found that out yet, you're missing something, because it is. We do God's work here. But I was brought to this sacred place, this fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this fellowship, I was brought to a program that I've gotten out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the first portion of it, the directions to wake up and get right and get integrated with this power. And having done that, I go back into the service, the third legacy, and pass this message on. Comes of Age is the basic service AA provides is carrying this message and actually take us at the heart of it. I feel very blessed and privileged to be able to pass this message on. My big book tells me I cannot pass something on that I haven't got. But see, you, through God, have given me something to pass on. Hope, which is what we do, which I didn't have when I got here. It has been the bright spot of my life, one of the many bright spots of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. To see others recover, to see loneliness vanish, to see fear fall from people, like a veil dropping. And see them wake up and then go back into the fellowship to seek the fellowship they crave, to create a fellowship around them as well as me. What a good deal. Because when I got here in 1988, it was completely the opposite of that. It was not like that at all. I was full of alcoholism and driven by fear. Had nothing to offer anyone. But people here who were awakened saw me walk in the door and they said, welcome. And little by slowly they passed this message on. My home group is the Free Spirit Group, located in Brooklyn, where I always share there. The only coin for membership in Brooklyn is a pinky ring, sunglasses, and gold jewelry. The guys in my group would think The Godfather was an educational movie. But that was my home, and I was brought there in 1988, and some wonderful, wonderful people put my life in. I remember looking for a sponsor when I got here to my home group. And the gentleman was put in my life, and we began a journey through the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood with this man. I worked with him for many, many years. And about almost 2 years ago, about 18 months ago, a new teacher was put in my life. And I'll talk about that for a second before I get into tell you how I got here. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous 13, 14 years, doing the deal, working with the sponsor, sponsoring a bunch of guys, speaking all over, doing the disciplines, and something was going on that I could not explain. And what was happening to me, I was hitting a wall. And what I was experiencing was that reconstruction of the ego, the reemergence of ego. It was doing my thinking for me. And I got to a place in Alcoholics Anonymous, separated from alcohol, sober, doing the deal, wondering what's going on. I flatlined in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't believe it. It was a rude awakening. And I had acquired some contempt prior to investigation on a lot of practices to do along with Alcoholics Anonymous in our big book, not instead of. And a lot of contempt prior to investigation in many areas, and that stuff was killing me. Attachments were killing me. Old belief systems were killing me. And out of pain and desperation, I made a prayer to my loving Father, and I says, Father, I'm in trouble. No thoughts of a drink or anything like that. My life wasn't crumbling, but I felt something in here that was not right, and I was hitting a wall. And God, like always, answers our prayers the way He thinks they need to be answered. And He put a gentleman in my life, Mark H. from Texas. And I sat down with my current sponsor, and he says, if we go through this work, your life is going to be turned upside down. Are you ready for that? And I thought maybe he needed a sponsor to go through the steps with. My life has been completely revolutionized again. One of the things I had to sit with going through this work, again, going through the first 9 proposals and being rocketed and entering the world of spirit in 10, 11, and 12, is why am I going through this work again? Even though I'm flatlining, am I going to go through this work and the motive is going to be so I can acquire some more knowledge, so I can go into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and give everyone sound bites to sound really profound and still die on the inside? Was it that, or was it about acquiring a better or deeper relationship with the power that was keeping me sober all along? What was the deal? I knew it had to be about waking up, growing up spiritually, getting a deeper relationship with God, the power that I ought to be worshiping all the time. Because what I experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, in that little flatline, were things like this. I become a prey to comfortability in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we get around here a little while. And we start to wake up a little bit. And we get jobs. You know, the wife lets you back in the bedroom. We put some money in our pocket and we start to look good. We start to speak at meetings. We work with others. And my illness tells me everything's okay. It got comfortable. You don't have to work that hard. And any lens becomes on my terms, not what the sponsor has told me. And little by slowly, I walk into being a prey to comfortability. Our big book talks about resting on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do. This thing called alcoholism is not going to announce its arrival. Like tomorrow morning, Pete, 10 o'clock, we're going to go get drunk, so go get ready. It's not going to do that. It's a subtle folk, sly, clever, devious, and difficult to detect. The other thing I start to do is worship my emotions, and that was just, I slipped right into that one. You know, if I feel good today, I must be doing something spiritual, right? And so tomorrow when I'm not feeling so good, I must be doing something wrong spiritually. And instead of worshiping the power, I start to worship my emotions. And you know what happens when I start to do that? I start to reach outside of me to feel good all the time. I start to try to acquire things and do things to make me feel good because I'm trying to catch that good feeling instead of being with the power all the time who will move me. I hit my 7th step, and it was my first step for life all over again. I was at a place of the jumping off place in here. What was I going to do? Was God everything or nothing? And I experienced that in my 7th step where it was my first step for life. I have found here, and it has been done for me by a loving God, it's about complete removal in order to wake up. I would always go out there and try to reach out for stuff. Get the job, get the money, get the right girl, get the right car, all of that stuff. You know, go to the gym, do everything possible so I can fill up that hole in the soul. And what needed to be done was the removal. And what was I removing? Old ideas, prejudices, judgments, concepts, all of it had to be completely removed. Belief systems, even my idea about God, because what I started to do was put God in a box. I know my God. Well, that's great, but I knew Him so well, He was in a box. And you know what happened? I started to experience some current unmanageability because God was going to take care of my booze problem. I was sober. He was doing it. But when it came to sex, money, relationship, marriage, job, well, maybe I should just run the show a little bit here. When it would hit the fan, I would have my back against the wall. Where was I going to go but to me and not to God? And that's a terrible place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, when God is not everything. One of the assignments my sponsor had me do was going through chapter diagnostics and doing our second step considerations. It says, is God everything or is God nothing? What was our choice to be? Right? Well, at the beginning, you know, we want to be really good students. So you say, well, God's everything. Okay, great. How does that look like when you're finishing up amends and hitting the world, entering the world of the Spirit in 10, 11, and 12? Is God really everything? Or is He everything when I want Him to be? What's that look like? God's everything. What does that really look like? Is God really everything? And that was a rude awakening for me because you know what I found out? God wasn't everything. Peter was everything in a few areas, and God was what I want him to be. And I put God in the box. I started to experience some current unmanageability. I was in self, which meant I was in fear, and I was flatlining, wondering what's going on. The difference now, what I've come to experience is, I work very, very, with a lot of enthusiasm with 10 and 11 disciplines, especially my 11th step, has taken, given my life new meaning, taken me to a different place. But many times in meditation, I'll sit there for a week straight, 2 weeks straight, 3 weeks straight, and I feel like I'm getting nothing. And what I have found out is this, it's like plowing the field and waiting for something to grow. So I take the action and God does the growing. And now I'm just able to be and sit and wait. Because I've had, it's been given to me many times some wonderful experiences in 11-step meditation. Some great things that have completely revolutionized my life. If you're sitting here tonight and you're a real alcoholic, my experience will tell you, your sponsor better be a real alcoholic. Because if they're a moderate drinker or a hard drinker or one of those people who can tell you put the plug in a jug and don't drink and go to meetings, you're probably going to get drunk and die off of that one. Because some very loving people told me when I was first coming around, my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, Pete, just put the plug in a jug and all I want to do is take it out and go get drunk. Step one tells me I'm powerless over alcohol, which means I don't have power, choice, and control. If I could just not drink and go to meetings, why would I have to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I would stay home and not drink. But I can never pull that off. I could never do it. And I got grace for my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was told, don't drink and go to meetings, put the plug in a jug, and I was completely out of my mind running around Alcoholics Anonymous untreated, and all I wanted to do was drink. Got 6 months of grace. And I showed up at a gentleman's house in Minneapolis, and I told him about my dramas of life. It was December 22nd, 1988. I was separated almost 6 months to the day. I was kind of dating some girl, and she said, enough of you, you know, and she went her own way. I still didn't have a job. It was about 55 feet of snow outside of Minnesota. I wanted to go home. I was homesick. I was running around untreated, full of me, driven by fear, selfish, self-centered to the core. And I showed up at this guy's house, and I said, Joe, what do I do? Here's my dramas of life. And I shared with him this long, long story about me. And he says, Peter, where were you with God in the 12 steps? And I said, the steps, you know, when do you start? And he says, when you stop throwing up, you're late. And he disturbed me on the question of alcoholism. He got me angry. But there was something about him that convinced me he was giving me truth. One of the greatest things I found in here is not only the words that many great teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous speak, but it's what I see with my own eyes on what they do and how they be. They would take me from the meeting. There was a meeting out in Minneapolis called the Three Legacies Meeting. They would take me from that meeting. It would fill up this room every Friday night. And the speaker would get up there to the podium and give his or her talk. And after that meeting, they would take me out to a diner, or they would invite me into their homes, and I saw how they lived outside of here. And those words spoke volumes for me. I saw how their relationships were with their spouses were, how they treated their kids and how their children treated them. They were employed. They were living a wonderful life. And I says, how do you do that? Because I came by way of sleeping in hallways into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see men get up to the podium dressed with a shirt and tie, a wedding ring and a watch, with their big book, standing there looking with dignity. This was a new world to me. God, I wanted it in the worst way. I wanted it just so bad because everyone looked to be in a place of peace, ease, and comfort, and they all talked about having an experience with this power. And I share this because if you knew, get a sponsor who's a real alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic. And you go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you do all the things that you're told to do in here, with the fellowship, with the program, and with service, you will not experience relief from that. You won't. What I can promise is you, what you will experience is freedom. And there's a big difference between relief and freedom. I experience relief. It's bondage. It's running from meeting to meeting to meeting and dumping my dramas of life, waiting for the next thing to break, thinking about drinking all the time. Everyone else is wrong and I'm right. When is it going to end? I can't take it anymore. I should go double up on my meetings and I'll make more coffee. I'll do all of this stuff. That's relief. So for the hour, I kind of like settle in. And as soon as the gavel hits and we end with the Lord's Prayer, you hit the fresh air and it's back again. Freedom is freedom because we wake up. And somewhere when we have an experience with this power, really have an experience with this power, no matter what type of dramas of life you may be experiencing, you know deep down inside, like I do right now in my current life, know I'm going to walk right through with dignity, with respect, and I'm going to be taken care of. And when I get to the other side, it's always going to be glorious. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oftentimes in AA, we talk about love and service, love and service. You want to see the real deal with love and service? Maybe after this meeting tonight, maybe after a home group meeting or a local meeting. Meeting breaks up, going to the parking lot, you see one drunk work with another drunk, a half hour, an hour. Maybe everyone's home, you're still in the parking lot with another drunk. You invite a drunk into your house, a new prospect, and sit down and go through the work with them. Take them through their fourth step. Let them invite them over to your house and do a fifth step with them. You know what that's like when you sit down for the first time and do a fifth step. You're shaken. And we comfort them when we walk them through that stuff. And you see them going out and make amends, and then they're working with others. What a good deal. Great stuff. God separated me from alcohol on June 23rd, 1988. My family's been reassembled since. I've been able to do wonderful things in Alcoholics Anonymous because of his loving power. And no matter how much I tell you about God, how much I tell you what he's done for me, when it comes to talking about God, silence makes more sense because I do an injustice to God. But even if I tell you all the great things he's done for me, it still doesn't even cut the ice. It don't do it. If all of us together put on a piece of paper the wonderful things God has done for us, we still fall short because God just is. I picked up my first drink when I was about, maybe 14. I grew up in Brooklyn. And I never forget it. It was a Saturday night across the street from a church in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And I remember what was going on with me prior to this. I was driven by 100 forms of fear. I was shaking my shoes over everything. You know, when you're so insecure about yourself that your heart's beating every time someone asks you a question like, what's your name? And you're trying to think of what's the right answer. You know, the sweat would come off your forehead and you would hear your voice because you're so nervous. You would hear yourself talking. That's how I walked around until I picked up my first drink. This Saturday night was certainly no different. I watched my friends drinking cold 45 beer. I remember my first drunk man like it happened a week ago. I remember the guys on the corner, they were passing around a quart of beer, and they were joyous, happy, and free. They were in the moment. They were part of life at last. They had arrived. You know, and I wanted desperately to be like them. But the judge in my mind kept telling me, don't you dare because you're such a loser. And I had a part of me, this victim thing that goes on inside of us, that believed everything this screaming voice was telling me. You're a loser. You're right. Let me take my hat and go home. I wanted to hang out with the guys on the corner. This was spring summertime in January 23rd, about 6 months prior, about my mom, who suffered from this thing called alcoholism and experienced that incomprehensible demoralization that a big book talks about too many times, over and over and over again, got to a place where dying looked like the solution to the problem, which is what alcoholism loves to do, bring us to death's door. Wants me dead, settle for me drunk, and she took her life that night. And I was completely leveled by it. I've been locked up too many times. I've been homeless too long. A lot of ugly things have happened to me at the hands of alcoholism. I bought that. When she split, I didn't know what to do. And this guy called God I was really angry with. Because my mom brought me up with really good values. She gave me good values. I'm a Catholic. She taught me how to pray, would take me to church, and all the things that you're supposed to do growing up. Would sit with me and do homework, you know. When I wasn't doing too good, she would sit and talk to me. And she always tell me how much God loves you. And I watch her get sicker and sicker and then die and take her life. And I wasn't sure about God. And I think that's where I separated from this power. I had this guy at home, cunning, baffling, and powerful. I call him Dad. He's a tough guy from South Brooklyn. In my mind's eye, he was, 20 feet tall. And whenever he would talk to me, I would listen about anything. I couldn't even look him in the eye. And he had given me many stern warnings about hanging out with these guys on the corner, the bums on the corner. He would tell me, don't bring any of those girls around the neighborhood, around the house, rather. And I would listen, except for this one night when my friends were passing around a quart of beer. And I don't know why till this moment, but I put my hand in there and I took a few pops. And you know what? Nothing happened when it hit my stomach. And on that, I took a few more drinks, and I drank a little bit more, and then I experienced something I never experienced before. A doctor's opinion talks about a sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking just a few drinks. Drinks I see others taking with impunity. My friends were drinking. They seemed to have their life together. They were like older guys, 16 and 17, basically old rebels without a clue, but they were there, I knew nothing about alcoholism, what makes me a real alcoholic, what separates me. And our book does a great job of doing that, doesn't it? You know, they talk about how this reaction to alcohol never occurs in the average temperate drink. It does with us. They talk about alcoholics of our type in that class, the real alcoholic on page 21. They constantly separate us. So if you're here tonight, you're not sure what you are, get someone to take you to the first 43 pages of this book. You'll find out what you are. And you may say, oh, no, I'm not an alcoholic, but that may be your freedom. Maybe you find out your truth. How can we build this based on a lie until we get to our truth first? So there I was, and I remember drinking a little bit more, and I drank a little bit more, and I started to feel really good, kind of like my friends were looking on the outside. I got to that place that was indescribably wonderful, and you know what? Little by slowly, I wasn't thinking about my mom anymore. This horrific thing that was tearing at me. I can't express enough how it just tore at me. She's gone. What do? My design for living was taken out of my lap. I was driven by fear as it was, and now this woman who was kind of like protecting me is gone. What do? As I continued to drink, I was not even thinking about my dad anymore. I remember thinking if I got fired up, I knew the cops were going to turn the corner. And of all the guys on the corner, they were going to get Pete Marinelli, handcuff him, and take him to jail. And for drinking cold 45 beer, I was going to do like 20 years in jail somewhere. And I wasn't afraid of cops. I wasn't thinking about the policeman anymore. I wasn't afraid of my friends. I wasn't afraid of anything. Bill says three great words. I had arrived. I arrived. What a good deal. I was part of life at last. I was awake to the present moment. My first drunk was indescribably wonderful. It was perfect. Many of us, I've heard, share terrible things happen to us on the first drunk. Bad things. Nothing like that to me. I remembered everything. You know, as I continued to drink, I remember, you know, the woman seemed to really want me as I got drunk. They were attracted to me, man. And suddenly I was able to talk. I'm serious. I'm not lying to you. Guy's looking at me like, I don't know about you, man. But what a good deal. You know, I experienced that ease and that peace, ease, and comfort. I was kind of back in my skin. I stopped vibrating. And I was able to roughhouse with the guys. And I remember I went home that night and my clothes weren't soiled. My teeth were still in my mouth. No black eyes, no soiled clothes, none of that stuff. When I woke up the next morning, Sunday morning, I remembered everything. There were no blackouts here. I remembered everything. There was no shame here either. What a good deal Saturday night was. And I remember thinking, next Saturday, I'm going down to the corner, and I'm not waiting because I'm going to drink and capture that elusive feeling and then get to that place out there that's indescribably wonderful, and everything's going to be perfect. It's going to be glorious. I found a solution to my problems, to my own bedevilments. It was called Colt 45 beer, and I want more. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, three things that separate me from others, mental obsession to alcohol. Big Book does a great job on it, much better than I can share tonight. But really, just to tell you, I would get in terrible trouble on Monday because of drinking, and Tuesday my mind would tell me Monday wasn't that bad. It was going to be a little bit different. When I was drinking, I was worried about the one backing up. When I wasn't drinking, all I could think about was drinking. I counted money in my pocket by bottles, not by money. I can buy this many. I can buy that. I can buy this. Not like I got, you know, 30, 40 bucks in my pocket. My mind would convince me to drink over and over and over again, regardless of the consequences. And once I picked up the drink, I suffered from this thing our doctor's opinion talks about, this phenomenon called craving, this allergic reaction to alcohol. My craving was always intensified whenever I drank. It was never satisfied. More was my drinking. I'll keep going. And it decided when I stopped drinking, not me. I remember, you want to see instant sobriety in the bar, yell out last call. Because suddenly Bo Derek looks like Bo Diddley and you wonder how to get into this deal. And I found out God has a sense of humor. I have no input into the decision that's made for me by this thing called alcoholism in my mind to go drink or not. It tells me drink, I drink. And I'll tell you this, if you're new especially, many times we'll hear an Alcoholics Anonymous, well, think the drink through. Well, guess what? You're playing Russian roulette. Because page 24 in our big book talks about that stuff. That it tells me at certain times I can't bring into my mind with sufficient force the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. You want to take that and try to think the drink through? You know what I would get to? Not too bad. I'll have a little more. I won't get in trouble this time. I can never just stop on my own. Part of the unmanageability was knowing I was going to pick up and not knowing exactly when, but knowing it was going to happen. My life revolved around alcohol. And the third thing was this thing they talk about, this spiritual malady. I think, I'm not sure, I may have been separated from this power when my mom passed, because I looked at God with kind of a different perception at this point. I think that's maybe where I was separated. I think we all get separated from this power somewhere. Because in our big book, in step 5, it talks about this new relationship with God. In step 3, it talks about being reborn. It's something new, because I think we all get separated from this power in different times in our lives. And I don't think God puts any of us here separated from Him. That would be a cruel and unjust God. My God's loving and caring like yours. We come in here, it says, our big book says, the great reality is deep down within. We all have the Spirit of God, but somewhere we get blocked. Part of fourth step is ripping the stuff out that's blocking us from this power so we can be reintegrated with it. And I got separated, and I was out there somewhere. And I start to get attached to my external world. I got attached to belief systems that weren't working for me, old prejudice concepts, all of it. And little by slowly, I start to walk away from this power. Thank God for our 12 steps, because part of it, 4 through 9, is about cleaning that stuff out. Removal. There's a buzzword around Staten Island, a great word. They talk about, I want to get to my truth. You got to know your truth. I have to find my truth. Truth, truth, truth. And sometimes, and I was guilty of it, looking at getting to my truth like it's a spot on the map, like it's a spot across the room. There's truth. I'm going for it. You know how you get to truth? It's by waking up. It's by, again, removal, by dropping a lot of things. We wake up to things that do not work for us anymore. They lose power. And waking up is not pleasant. It is not comfortable. It doesn't feel good waking up, losing old things. When I hit my 7th step, I said it was my first step for life, and I felt like I was at the jumping off place. It was as if everything was removed and I had nothing. I stood before my God with absolutely nothing. I'm saying 14 years, this is what's happened to me. Everything's removed. It was about being reborn. That's what was happening. Spiritual warriors embrace change. We go through change. It's a great thing. Because there's greater pain in staying still than going through. It's bondage. But it's comfortable. It's familiar. I'll stay here and sick. And my illness loves it. It's going to say, just stay where you are. Don't do 4 through 9. Don't go through the steps again. Don't do multiple fifth steps. God forbid. You may get better. Attachments, my sponsor has shown me, and I found out from my own experience, attachments will kill me. And you want to know what your attachments are, sit down and do a thorough fourth step. Take the first 3 proposals, sit down with someone who's gone through this book, and take a look at 4. Principles, all attachments, I found out. I had more on this inventory than my first one going through, because I acquired attachments in Alcoholics Anonymous, too. One of the things I let go of was, you know, our big book talks about being quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer. I embrace that now. There was a time where I was like, had conditions on it. And I found that I can do it along with this, not instead of it. It has blown doors wide open for me. What a good deal. Open to new things in my life and embracing them. God has given me whatever it takes to embrace change. And there was a time where I was just scared to death of it because I liked what was familiar. And things have been removed, and there was a time where I'm going, God, what are you doing to me? I don't like what you're doing to me. I don't like what you're doing with my life. But I found out how limited my vision is. God sees all, and He moves. And at first, it's not comfortable. But He's made me wide open to take new things into my life, gifts, people, friendships, sponsor, home groups, prospects. Waking up is not pleasant, but getting to the other side of the archway is glorious, absolutely glorious. A lot more than I would have settled for when I got in here, because I just wanted one day away from a drink, and I, you know, felt like I hit the lottery. And God gives an abundance. You go to an ocean with a thimble, you're going to come home with a thimble full of water. And God's giving all of it to all of us. And it's there. So take. God's not going to run out of a supply. My drinking, as Bill says, assumed more serious proportions, and there were many unhappy scenes, as he says, in his sumptuous apartment in my home, because what my illness did was, instead of drinking on Saturday, it became Friday and Saturday, and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and I start to drink during the week, and I became my family's bedevilment, because they start to experience my alcoholism, and they didn't do anything. I had two kid brothers at home who idolized me, and little by slow they start to become afraid of me. Well, what was walking in the door? I would leave the house sober and come home drunk, very often a nasty, ugly drunk, dumping lots of earthy language in their laps. Ugly language about this guy God, who I'm not too thrilled about, this guy called Dad, who's cunning, baffling, and powerful. God took Mom, left me here. It was all about me, but I hated everything, and they got it. And they would do is tell my dad the next day, and my dad would get me in a corner and give me the father and son, longshoreman to son talk. It wasn't like Leave It to Beaver where the father had a shirt and tie and went into the library. You got it. Any room will do. And he would tell me about who I was hanging out with, the company I was keeping, that I was going to become. I could take these words. If I had a dollar for every time I heard him, I'd be a rich man. I was going to become a product of my environment. And my biggest problem with my drinking back then was their problem with my drinking. But they were suffering from my alcoholism, and they didn't do anything. The way my employer suffered from my alcoholism, and they didn't do anything. I never stand at a podium and tell anyone, just don't drink and go to meetings and you're a winner, because I'm lying. That's arrogant. That's selfish. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a selfish program. We hear that. Well, AA is a selfish program. Where? In my big book, does it say Alcoholics Anonymous is a selfish program? It is not. It's about giving all of it back the way you gave to me. And we take this in our book says, in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And the more I give, the more I wake up, the more I'm free. Why not? Well, let somebody else get that newcomer. I got to meet, little Susie in the parking lot and go to the diner. And the poor soul is dying in the corner because I got my life is too busy to go help the newcomer. It's about giving back in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we take this home. My family start to experience shame, bewilderment, despair, fear, all of it because of me and my alcoholism. And it wasn't because that I was that powerful, but this thing that owned me, alcoholism, was and still is. I start to steal from my family because alcoholism turned me into a coward. I didn't have the courage to go out and steal on the street yet. It was going to happen. But I start to steal from people who love me, my family. If there was 50 bucks in a drawer, in my mind, 30 was half and it goes with me. You're working, I'm not. Or if I was working, wasn't making enough money, and that's what I would do. And I would steal from my family. I would steal from my dad all the time. You know, he'd be in the kitchen having a coffee early in the morning, sitting there with his robe on, reading the papers, feeling safe in his own home, right? But I was there. And I would sneak into his bedroom and go into his pants pocket that was usually draped over the dresser. You did this too?
Yeah.
And go into his pocket and take some money out. And then my dad would see me come down for breakfast and would ask me, like any loving parent, you have enough money on you today? And I would tell him, I never forget, Dad, I could use a few bucks if you don't mind. And he'd go back upstairs, come down and put money on the table, put this in your pocket. And I just ripped them off. And I would do that. I would rip off my kid brothers who were going to school and had part-time jobs, trying to make their way. And I would rip them off. Have no problem with it. One morning I got up when Bill talks about when that morning terror madness was on him, it was on me, and I needed money to go get fired up, and I was starting to get sick already, and I was like a young buck here in alcoholism. I wasn't in this deal for a long time. I was young, and I was starting to experience that torment of waking up sick and the vibrating, and I need to get a drink. I need to get straightened out. What am I going to do? And, everyone was sleeping one morning, so I started going through, the drawers in the house, and I found my dad's checkbook, and I got the brainstorm. Well, if I forge his name on this check, I'll go to the bodega or the liquor store, and they'll cash it for me and get some liquor, get fired up, or get some beer. And so I did, and it worked a few times. And then I didn't know that you get checking your checks back in the mail. It's called checking statements. And he got that and then came looking for me. And I never forget, I was hanging out on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, right across the street from the Brooklyn Bridge. I was sitting in the car with a girl I was keeping company with at the time. And my dad drove up, and when he drove up and jumped out of the car and hollered my name, I knew this was going to be serious. And he hollered my name a few times, and he's a street guy, so if you can get the scene, it was like, you ever watch The Sopranos? I mean, this is what was going on. And I remember sitting in the car with this girl, and I said, oh, no, there's my dad. I'm in trouble. And he hollered my name. Now, common sense would say, turn the key over, throw the car in drive, and go away, right? I got out of the car, and I ran away. And he called my name a couple of times. I froze, and we met. And what I did like a coward was came up with a lot of fake tears. I started to cry. I blamed the girl in the car. I blamed the guys on the Lower East Side. I was a wannabe musician, so I was hanging out a lot of the clubs in downtown Manhattan, a lot of the rock clubs down there. And I said, well, it's the guys in the clubs. It's the clubs I'm hanging out with, that type of atmosphere. And my dad wasn't buying any of it at all. And he sent me off to my first rehab. And I had not conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I wasn't buying this deal. In fact, my first few rehabs, I went away to get the heat off. Got caught. Let's get out of here. You know, better than catching a beating or some other kind of deal. My dad never put his hands on me, but my mind says, better than catching a beating, we'll go to this rehab and we'll do the 28 days. And I went off to my first rehab, this really fancy place in Long Island. And my 28 days consisted of not listening to anything anyone had to say because I hadn't, you know, conceded deep down in here. In fact, one of my rehabs, there was a show called Miami Vice that was really popular. My higher power was Don Johnson. I wanted to dress like him, wanted to look like him, and Miami Vice was on. I'm sitting in rehab, and AA's on their way up, you know, to bring the meetings into the rehab. So I would put on the board, Miami Vice, 9 p.m., speakers, please leave promptly. I mean, that's how much, you know, I wanted to stay sober. And they would do the deal, and I wouldn't even listen to them. And my 28 days consisted of push-ups and sit-ups. I learned words like dysfunctional family enablers and a lot of other words. Now, dysfunctional family, I don't like to use that word too much. It's a good way of keeping me sick. There were things that went on in my house with an older cousin that no young boy should ever experience. And I bet a lot of us have those type of stories behind closed doors. Not functional, obviously. The last thing my illness needs is for me to be attached to that too, because then I separate myself from you a little bit more. I'm an alcoholic like you, but I have these other issues, and I separate myself from you. It is what it is. And guess what? Going through this work and seeking some outside help, that part, that horrific part of my life when I was a little boy around 7 or 8 years old, has been put away. It's done. I even reached a place of forgiveness for that person. It's done. That's why I can look myself in the mirror and not feel like I did anything wrong, because there's a long time I felt haunted by stuff like that. Same thing when my mom died. The first funeral I ever walk into has to be my mom. I'm a little guy. First thing I see is my mom lying there. And there were many things that happened to me as a young boy, like, you know, hiding her liquor, hiding her pills. And the first thing I thought of when I saw her lying there was, I should have done something to stop this. I could have stopped her death. And I walked with that for a long time. That's why I hold on to my pillow at night so tight that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you have gotten me free of that. That's no longer haunting me. That's a terrible thing to grow up with, any of us who have stuff like that. Those are haunting nightmares that maybe I could have done something different. Maybe I could have prevented it. Whatever went on, went on. I don't like to say dysfunctional enablers, because some of those people aren't in here to defend themselves. I won't say enablers. My family gave me everything they had and took away. Gave me and took away, trying to save my life, helping me hit a bottom before maybe I would on my own, raising the bottom, helping me see truth. Did the very best they could with what they knew. You only know what you know. Anyway, I wound up going away to my first rehab, and I hit my second rehab, and I hit my third rehab, and I hit my fourth rehab, and I got a job as a longshoreman on the Brooklyn waterfront, not the training ground for spiritual growth. Guys are like fed up with the day at 6 a.m., and there I am. And I brought this thing down there, and my dad walked with this impeccable reputation and started to experience more shame and more horror because of me. I was getting in trouble, getting paid, disappearing, doing a lot of things illegal for the price of a drink, borrowing money off of people who wanted a little bit back every week, you know, and they would, you know, make appointments to come see you if you didn't. And I had no way of paying these people back. And my dad would get me out of scrapes like this and cover up for me. And how unfair just to say don't drink and go to meetings. Those people... Are any of our friends here from Al-Anon tonight, welcome, and I thank you for nursing us back to health and staying with us and doing your deal for us. But how arrogant would it be, again, just to say, well, I got mine and let my family take care of them. I'm supposed to go back and walk with them now. Because a truly awake man walks with others, you know. And that's what we're supposed to do. So welcome to any Al-Anon friends here tonight. All right, thank you. I hit my fifth rehab and got bounced off the waterfront a few times, by the way, but managed to, for a little while, save my job. And I hit my fifth rehab, and I spent 9 weeks in my fifth rehab. And I was separated from alcohol for 9 weeks, physically separated from alcohol. I was out on a Saturday and drunk on a Monday. Because what I have found out from my own experience, and I'll talk only on experience tonight, because if I don't, I'm lying to you. But being physically separated from alcohol has very little to do with being a recovered alcoholic. It just means I'm separated. You know, it doesn't mean anything about waking up the spirit and giving me a new mind. It just means I'm separated. Throw this out for some consideration. A teacher in my life gave me this one and shook me up a little bit, disturbed me on the question of alcoholism. We say we've gone through the work. We've entered the world of the spirit, right? So the big book says, enter the world of the spirit as we cleaned up the past. And then we're doing 10 and 11. We tell people, I've made my amends. I'm in 10 and 11. I'm working with others. Any outstanding amends we have tonight that we're aware of that we have not made yet? And if we haven't, how come? Is there a first step reservation going on? Have I become the power? Has any of us become on my terms? And really, have I gone through the work? If I have amends I could be making tonight or tomorrow or yesterday, and I'm not, because I'm a prey to comfortability. Have I really entered the world of the Spirit? Have I really experienced the glory of God when I still have outstanding amends that I refuse to go? Because suddenly my mind tells me they're not that important. Go ask them if they're that important. You hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, well, we irritated more people than we really harmed. I annoyed more people than I really harmed. And my question was to them is, good, go ask those people if you annoy or harm them. Let them be the ones to decide. That's any lens. That's rubber hitting the road. A book talks about how to approach the man we hated will arise. I had one of those on my list, like a lot of us. The difficult ones seem to be the most beneficial. I showed up at a landlord's house. I did not want to go see this man. I showed up at his house. One of the most difficult amends for me to make. I don't remember walking back to my car because it was that glorious on the other side of it. But out of my fifth rehab, I went right back to the streets again. I picked up a drink and I was right back in the same vicious cycle and alcoholism only once again. Stopping was not an issue. It was like, I can't stop. And I got bounced off the waterfront. I was living in this apartment that turned into the Lower East Side. It turned into the Bowery. It was a horror show. My bed was soiled. I wasn't making it to the bathroom at night, nor did I care. I was living like a bum. And I was in this apartment. I prayed to die every night. And I got bounced out of this apartment. I went to live on the streets, and I spent about a day and a half in my sixth rehab. And I signed myself out, and I went to live on the streets again. And truly, by the grace of God, I hit my seventh and, God willing, last rehab, and I was separated. I was outside the Port Authority, and I had this moment of clarity. And what I did with that was curse God for doing all of these things to me. Short time later, God served me once again my truth, that flimsy reed, and I held on for dear life because I knew this was it. And really, through a series of circumstances and God working through my dad, who I would not be here tonight if it wasn't for the power God gave him, you'd have a new speaker here tonight, a different speaker. I wound up in my, God willing, seventh and last rehab and went through the whole detox thing. And this last time was just a horrific detox. It was agony. And after about 10 days of being in there, I was thinking about drinking again. And they sent me off to Minnesota. And people there told me I must find a spiritual base of life or else. And I was experiencing or else. I knew what that was about. And they told me that the solution was in a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that was going to take me to a God. This book will enable me to find the power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. This book, this simple book, I have an experience with this book. I'll have an experience with a God of my understanding. And it was my God, my personal God, not necessarily your God. What a good deal. What great freedom. Chaptic Agnostics blows the doors on the concepts of my old concepts of God, blows the doors wide open. Willing to believe, yes or no. My own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient. Well, what great news. And after about 10 months of living in Minnesota, I was brought home to my current home group, the Free Spirit Group. And my first appointed teacher showed up. And like I said earlier when I opened this talk, my second teacher showed up about 18 months ago. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to my life, called Alcoholics Anonymous, because it allowed me to experience some wonderful, wonderful things and allowed me to walk through things that weren't so wonderful with dignity, not on my power, just on the glory of God. What good stuff. I haven't had an obsession to drink alcohol in a very, very long time since I began this work. If someone's telling you it's natural to think about drinking because you're an alcoholic, or if you have an obsession to drink alcohol, that's normal because you're an alcoholic, I'll be the first guy in line to tell them they're lying to you. It's contrary to my big book. We're placed in the position of neutrality, safe and protected. That's great news. If you hear suffering with the obsession and you're about to go out the door, or you meet somebody who's like that, my book promises me just the opposite. Safe and protected. That's God. Safe and protected. Remember when it was like where you weren't? We come here and that's what happens. We wake up. I hope to always give back with the same love and gratitude that you have given to me every day. A day at a time. The way I live a day at a time. But my spirit, I always remember, does not wear a watch. It's able to be and is. When I'm integrated with that spirit, I'm not in before. I'm not later on. I'm here and now, awake to this present moment, this new breath, this new moment. It's great. It's glorious. I feel privileged to be here, and I thank you for this gift of sobriety. Thanks. Hi, I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for coming back. Before I get going here, just a few people I need to... give thanks to friend Jeff, first time. I've heard lots about Jeff from Syracuse over the years, and it's a pleasure to finally meet him and try to talk him into smoking some cigars with me. But thank you for being here. My dear friends from Staten Island, Gerard and Linda here, came up from Staten Island to give me some support. And just a gift, an absolute gift in my life. My friend Linda from New Jersey is here to be supportive. So I just wanted to say thank you to all of you for being there for me and all of you for being there for me. Before I get into talking this about this Iceland experience and my experience I'm looking forward to, I should say, in November visiting Denmark and some of the lead up to that and what their correspondence with me has been about, which is nothing short of exciting. I had a question from a woman about what I do for my 11-step practice and what that's all about. And so I was told it was okay to share some of that stuff, what I do with my practices. And what I have found out here is we do a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. We work our steps. We do service. You know, people here tonight, Bill, very grateful that Bill will be here tonight and taping and doing all these wonderful things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out that their point is to this power. Their point is to this power. And they take us to this place of being integrated with this power. But I found out the very things that take us to God, if we're not careful, can be the very things that that block us from God, that take us away from this. We need to go in order to go out. If I don't go in, I will go without. But if I go in too long, I better look out like this. You hear what I just said? Because we can worship the methodology rather than the power itself. I had a friend of mine who was doing a meditation. He's sitting in meditation as long as he was, and he hears his wife call from another room to give her help with something, and she's called a second time and a third time, and he barked back to her out of a meditation, "God damn it, can't you see I'm meditating?" You know, it's like driving a car, cutting people off, flipping them the bird because you're going to go talk on the 11th step in about 10 minutes, you know. So one of the things, I say that because there was a time when I would worship the methodology. I would worship everything I had to do in the morning, worship everything that I was doing with this work. All the I's had to be dotted and T's had to be crossed. And I don't want to in any way sound like I'm minimizing the information with the steps. They're vital. They're crucial. We need to follow directions. But we can get so tight with that stuff, it becomes competitive. Well, I did my fourth step better than you, or I did my ninth step better than you. And that's not what God's looking for us to do, man. It's about waking up, worshiping Him, and giving this back. There was a time where I would sit in meditation. I had to read so many those meditative books, meditation books we have, read the page out here, read a page out here, and I was becoming neurotic. I'm late for work, but I meditated. You know, that type of stuff. Neglect chores and responsibilities because I have to go meditate now. You know, I got into doing that stuff because I got so tight with it. And then, you know what? I'm supposed to be doing this and practicing this stuff. And I would go to a meeting. I was just talking to someone about this. And I would listen to someone's experience with their God, and I would judge it. And they're walking around maybe blissful, and I'm judging it because they're doing it a little bit different than me, and that's not what this is about. Very often what I don't know, I fear. So what do you do with that? Got to shoot it down, like gossip. Got to shoot it down because it's a threat to me. And I had contempt for an investigation. I've been working with some other things along with Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of. My current practice, I've been brought up in this thing with writing a lot. I write lots of inventory. That's just the way I do it. I kill too many trees, I'll be honest with you. But I write. I put pen to paper about a lot of things in my life. My 11-step practice consists of doing a nightly review. And I review. It's my net for whatever inventories I didn't do during the day or things that may have kicked up that I missed. And I'll sit down at night and write some inventory. And I'll do my evening, my right now my meditative life is 3 times a day in meditation. And before I go any further, the question to consider is, how is your meditative life? Do you have one? Do we have one? Very often you go to meetings and, you hear, well, prayer is talking and meditation is listening, and that's all you're getting out of a meeting. How often in Alcoholics Anonymous is the topic of a meeting meditation? And then you really get into some of the practices. You don't hear it enough. How's our meditative life? At the very beginning, they did a lot of it, and the recovery rate was through the roof. We don't do enough of it. I don't know how the recovery rate is. So it's really important to me, this meditative life. What am I doing with it? What practices, what techniques am I doing to wake up and get still and be present to this moment, to work with this breath right now, this new moment, this new breath, never experienced before, but here it is. Am I awake to it, or am I constantly looking for futures? You know, we do that, we get attached. Well, when this gets better, I will feel good, right? Wrong. It's when I wake up, everything around me is okay, and I would do this. Well, when I get the right job, when I get the right amount of money, when I get the right relationship, then I'm going to feel okay. When my boss treats me okay, then I'm going to feel good. And I'm constantly looking for new futures. I want to bring stuff in. I get attached to the external world, and I build up a false sense of me. What do I mean by that? You become who I really be inside. Because you like me, because you like me, because you like me, because you like me, I must be doing good. You know what? I'm in bondage because, God forbid, if I piss you off, the legs come out from under me and I'm attached to my external world and have a false sense of who I am. That's a terrible way to go through life. How can I be truthful to a drunk if I need him to like or her to like me? I can't pull that off. You have to like me. So I can't give you truth. But when that stuff gets removed, I'm no longer attached to the external world. I'm kind of in a place of PCs and comfort. Because there's only one power I need to be worshiping, and that's God. It's the most important relationship in my life. That allows me to love others. Even if I tell other alcoholics or people, I cannot prohibit this. I cannot permit this anymore. You have to go. Maybe a way of loving. I'm currently working at night. I do this practice of inventory, and I sit for 20 minutes in meditation, and I do I work with some prayers. Work with prayers. I sit in meditation. I call it a day, and my day is done. Throughout the day, if I have an opportunity to write, I will, and I certainly write at night and do a review. On awakening, I consider my plans for the day. I ask God to direct my thinking and being divorced from self. It's about removal of self. All the things I ask God to divorce are thinking from, what is that? Self. Dishonest, self-seeking motives, all of that. It's about all about me. That's got to go. Self has got to go. Successful living is daily dying. Must be rid of self. The death of self, and I will wake up. And if I'm truly living, aren't I full of death? By removing of self, death of self. The more self out of the way, the more I can embrace this power. It's that simple. The more human power I rely on, the less God power I can embrace, and vice versa. At this point, the road has really narrowed for me. There are certain things I could have gotten away with a long time ago. Can't pull it off anymore. There's a squeezing that goes on. The road has narrowed. But in this discipline, what great freedom we're working with this. What I do is on awakening, I was moved to do this, literally on awakening, when my eyes open, I got moved to do this a long time ago. I go to God and I thank him for another day. And I ask him at that point for the power to stay sober. Ask him for a few other things, not petition, so I can be of service to him and others around me. Then I go do my practice. My current practice consists of whatever the Spirit moves me to do. Remember I said I had to read this book, a little bit out of that book. If the Spirit moves me to read, I will read. If it doesn't, I don't, and I don't judge it. It's not about judging practices here. It's about letting the Spirit move me to where it has to move me. It's all good. Currently, I'm working with a few different books. In fact, my sponsor has me working with a few books outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done some great work with Sermon on the Mount and a few other books. Currently working with two books very closely and a lot of the practices. But I work with a few different meditation books in the morning right now. And I sit with my prayers. I have some prayers I work with, the third-step prayer, 11-step prayer, a prayer that's close to my heart that I work with. And then I sit. And I do minimum 20 minutes in the morning, and I've had incredible experiences that have been given to me in meditation. One of the experiences I've had in meditation is I found out this. For years, I would pray to this God, and I think I was kind of knowing God, but the question I always had to consider, does God know me, Pete Marinelli? And that was always a question mark. Does God really know me, Pete Marinelli? Well, guess what? I would go to God with certain things. I would go to God and ask him, Father, please guide me with this. And then certain things would happen in my life, and I was convinced that God knew me. And what a great deal when you find out through experiences that God knows you. What a good deal that he knew what I was thinking. He knew what I was feeling. See, our big book says sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. When God shows up, God shows up. And it's profound. It's mood-altering. It's transforming. It's revolutionizing. God shows up. You know about it. And you could be in the grocery store, driving in your car, whatever you're doing, you know it. Something is going on that words cannot explain. You can't explain the experience. You just can't. In fact, I'll tell you this. Really, tonight, don't see me for the words I speak. I invite you into my life and see what God has done for me. And then maybe once you see how I live, how I try to do this deal, how God allows me to do this deal, then my actions may give my words that much more depth and weight and credibility. And I can never say that, but I invite you into my life. I don't mean you have to follow me home to Staten Island, by the way. But you know where I'm going with that. I invite you into my life. I'm not ashamed of anything. I work with great practices. I'm a Catholic, and I work with something else also in the middle of the day. I have the opportunity to work with this practice in the middle of the day. It makes my third meditation and prayer during the day, and it has been indeed miraculous for me. Working with this technique has given me an experience of meditation that once again I knew God knew me, Pete Marinelli. But I'll share something real quick, and I'll get into Iceland and Denmark in a sec. When I was out there, I remember making these pleas to God about, I was in this gray area. I wasn't in a blackout. I was just blind drunk. And I remember just talking and rambling. And I make these petitions to God in these tears. Please make my mom show up. Just please, just one time. I will stop all of this if you make her show up. I just want to hold my mother. I didn't get the opportunity. She was taken from me as a young boy. If you're out there and had a few choice words for God, but please make her show up. And I will stop this drinking. I will put it away. The other things I'm doing, I will stop. I will straighten my life out and walk a good path. Just please make my mom show up. And obviously that didn't happen. Well, when I get sober in 1988, I'm getting moved. And, you know, when God wants to move, you get moved. And you can't even explain it, but you know you're doing certain things. And you find out that you were moved by this power. And right from the get-go, I found myself going to church and lighting candles. I saw my friend Linda lighting candles. I was very, very touched by that. That's a great thing. Counting days, and I'm going to church, and I'm showing up in church. And if you're not a Catholic, please forgive me. I'm not trying to bring religion to this. I'm just trying to be as delicate as I can about this experience in sharing it. But I would go to church, and I would light two candles, and I was moved to light one for the sick and suffering in and out of the rooms. Now, here I am counting days, and I knew it was God, because what newcomer, you know, gets, it's all about me, not the sick and suffering in and out of the rooms. What do I care? You know, give me a cup of coffee, let me dump my drama's life, and I'm going home. But I was moved to do this, and the other candle I lit was for my mom. And I would sit in prayer and say, you know, God, if you're out there, take care of my mom and the sick and suffering. I get some quiet time, and I would light these two candles. And I was doing it regularly. I was going to church twice a week, sometimes three times a week, once a week minimum for years. Never thought anything about it. Not looking for a payoff. No goal. Just you get moved to do it and you do it like you do everything else, right? And I'm in meditation. I'm sober now, about 8 or 9 years at the time. And I sit in this meditation and I find myself on this beach and I'm sitting there and I look off to the horizon where the sky meets the water, where it meets. And what comes walking to me is my conception, if you will, of my higher power, the one I pray to and believe in. By now I was believing in God because I was having experiences with this power. And he walks towards me, and out of him, right from his chest, if you will, appears my mom. And the two of them walk towards me. And from being an adult, I became this little 8-year-old boy. And what she did was she kneeled down, and she had tears rolling down her cheeks and of her face. But they weren't tears of sorrow. They were tears of joy, and I was convinced of that. And there were no words spoken through this entire meditation, through this whole experience. But you know what's going on. And she kneeled down and she held on to me. I remember holding on to her very tightly. And then she stood up and my higher power put his arm around my shoulder. I was an adult again. And he looked at me in the eyes and he told me that she was okay, that she was with me. And the peace and love, that joy that came from his being to me, was something I've never, ever experienced before in this meditation. It was, the word is, I guess, bliss. It was as safe as I've ever felt in my life. And then my mom, you know, pointed off to the horizon on the left. And she pointed at all these lights. There were hundreds of lights lit up, hundreds and hundreds of lights, like a Manhattan skyline, flickering lights almost. And then she pointed off to the other side of the horizon, and there were hundreds and hundreds of lights lit up, like a Manhattan skyline. And then she walked over to me and held me as an adult and held on to me. And I remember not wanting to let go. We stepped back. She walked with my higher power. They became one, and I came out of meditation. And I remember being very moved by this, very emotional about it. And it was just so real and profound for me, but very confused. And so I called up my sponsor, and I shared right out of this experience that I just had. And he said, Peter, haven't you been lighting candles for your mom for about 8 or 9 years now? And I says, well, yeah. He says, well, she let you know she got them. She finally got them. And I remember it was as if the fist of Gulliver ripped out the last of that block between me and this power. It was just ripped right out, and I was free and clean. And I knew, I remember thinking, he knows me. Because I've been doing this for so long. All of that stuff came to fruition in God's time, not a second before, not a second later. Perfect God's time. Some great things that happened to us. I've had more like that, but for the sake of time, you know, I don't have time to share all of them. And I don't deserve any of it. But we do the deal here, and God just gives. You go to an ocean with a thimble, you're coming home with a thimble full of water, and God's giving it all. Sometimes we get dry in meditation and all we're doing is plowing the field for new growth. We keep hanging in there. We keep working with this. You know, sometimes it's a little bit painful. Hey, when's God going to show up in my life? But greater pain and not doing the work and never experiencing this great power. There's some other practices I've been working with for a while now, some other things that I had contempt prior to investigation about. I was talking to my friend here, and it has completely just, again, blew the doors wide open to new practices, new techniques to get a deeper relationship with this power, being quick to see where religious people are right, spiritual teachers, gurus, enlightened people, going to them, listening to them, seeing what they have to say, studying their books, working with their books, having experience with their books, along with this, not instead of this. Because I've seen people 11-step themselves right out of Alcoholics Anonymous because they do that instead of this. I'm a drunk. I need AA. More than you need me. Not too long ago, I got to visit Iceland, and I was invited there by a friend of mine, from a couple of friends from Texas, Chris Raymond, Myers Raymond, and I know they don't mind me using the name at the podium. They said, they called me up, they said, we're going to Iceland, we'd like you to come along with us, we're going to go do this deal in Iceland. And I had to go on the internet and try to find world map to find out where I was going. I said, I'm going to Iceland. I'm thinking it's like down the block, man. I'm from Brooklyn. What do I know about a world map, right? So I find out where I'm going. I said, well, it's pretty far, but away we go. When God wants to move you, you're getting moved. And we get to Iceland, and I cannot explain. I was sharing with my friend Linda about the experience in Iceland when we hit the podium. The amount of enthusiasm that we got, it was incredible. And I just want to share about that for a second. I get up to the podium that Friday night to give a half-hour pitch on my story. And I said my name is Peter. When they announced my name, there was this thunderous applause. And I said, they must not know me because I don't deserve that type of applause. I said, Peter, I'm an alcoholic. And the response back, like, hello, Peter, like we do that, almost knocked me off the podium. And I told Chris, you're going to give a pitch tomorrow night. Wait and see how this is going to be. And he almost like felt like he was going to get knocked off the podium. They were that enthusiastic about this message. The message in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you look at the third edition on the fly page, it says, but the basic text pages 1 to 164 remain unchanged. This is the AA message. And that's what we have experience with and we're going to share. What message are we carrying? You know, that's a question we need to consider. What am I carrying? Big Book says I can't transmit something I haven't got. And we've had some experience with this, so we go there. Speaking to a lot of the people in Iceland, just some wonderful, wonderful people, men and women doing a deal, a lot of young people. And I hate to say this, but there are a lot of old timers who do not want to know, this is out there, who do not want to know about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They call them the Taliban. That's what they refer to people doing the book. Ain't that terrible? You know what we call people do the book home? Big Book Nazis. How dare I call someone trying to save someone's life a Big Book Nazi? How dare I use that same word along with Alcoholics Anonymous? But that's what goes on. Call me a Big Book dumper, call me a step burger, call me a moron. I don't really care. But why call someone who's doing this deal, who's trying to do this deal, a Big Book Nazi? How disgusting. And they call them the Taliban out there. What we fear, we hate. And that's what's going on. There were people, brothers and sisters of, like us in Iceland, who were dying until about 5 years ago because they were real alcoholics and they were being told, don't drink and go to meetings and put the plug in a jug like we hear here. And people die with that and they were watching people around them die. They couldn't get it. I go to a meeting, I sit down with someone 20, 30 years sober, he says, just put the plug in a jug and I'm getting out of here and I'm going to go drink. I ain't even sticking around for the whole meeting. And somehow, a few years ago, the book started to come alive again. It had to be God to, you know, it starts with a mustard seed. And they start to do the deal and people start to sober up and stay sober and work with others. And I was flattered to hear them say that they had heard some of my tapes and Chris's tapes and Myers tapes and they were really into hearing what we had to say. And we showed up there and we gave our stories and we also did a workshop on spirituality and sponsorship and singleness of purpose. The response we got was incredible. They still email us about what's going on, and there's a great thing going on in Iceland right now, clusters of enthusiasm about this book, this message, this fellowship, this sacred place called AA. They went back. I did Fellowship of the Spirit in Queens not too long ago in New York, and a few of them came over and participated in that because they wanted to carry this message. They were alive. The book was alive. They were awake. Through that, some friends in Denmark invited me out there. I'm going out there with a friend of mine November 19th. We're going to do this weekend out there. We're going to be out there for like 5 days. And they're expecting like 400 or 500 people to show up. I'm going to do a pitch out there on my story and then go through this big book with a friend of mine, Tom, from Staten Island. And they're waiting for us to show up so they can get some information from our experience and go and carry it and pass it on. That's what we do. We pass it on. Great experiences. The other thing I will tell you about Iceland, it is cold. Oh, baby. it was really cold. We were looking at glaciers and snow mountains, and I was in the corner shivering like I needed a drink. But it was beautiful. The people were absolutely wonderful. And, you know, who would have planned on that? In 1988, that I would be invited to go share my story and my experience with the steps to a place like Iceland or Denmark or the other places around the country I've gotten invited to and will be visiting shortly. My calendar is getting busier and busier and busier. Good stuff. In closing, again, let me thank Walter for this very kind invitation and taking us to dinner and having a really good deal and meeting all of you. I hope I said something tonight to maybe shake you up a little bit, to wake you up a little bit. Thank you for always, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, always being there for me. You've treated me with grace and dignity since I walked in here, and you didn't care what I had done and what I look like. You've always given me that, and for that, I'm just so grateful and so blessed to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.